Gentlemen, your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules. And at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to another edition of Banal of America, The Revival. And this is kind of how would I describe this? This is kind of an episode that's like been in the making in a way for a few years now. Because during my hiatus of podcasting, our guest tonight, Jonathan Vankin, came out with this book, and our mutual friend Adam Gorightly actually contacted me, and he's like, "Hey, if you're gonna be podcasting anytime soon," and this was like a couple of years ago at this point, or 3 years ago, I think. He's like, "My friend Jonathan Vankin's come out with this book, Close to Zero, and it's about COVID and Donald Trump." And I'm like, "Oh shit, this sounds awesome," because I mean, we all lived through that. We all kind of experienced the madness that was that. And so I actually have had, I hold it up. I always do this for the guests, even though we're not on video. I hold it up. See, I have the book. I've read the book. It's like, it must be like my guilty high school year background. It's like, I did the work. So I actually ordered the book, and it was, you know, kind of on the pile for like when Banal of America comes back. It was like, when Banal of America comes back, here's, you know, this is the list. There's a list of people that I want to talk to. And on the list, on the pile, was Jonathan Vankin's book. So, you know, as we got rolling along here with Banal of America, the timing just kind of worked out where it was like, I mean, I know that COVID kind of, we'll get into all this, it kind of began sort of like towards the end of 2019 and was kind of rumbling along. But to me personally, I always kind of think of March 11th, 2020, as sort of the day when it all became fucking real. Because that was like the trifecta of like, this is fucking getting nuts. It was like the NBA canceled a game because one of the players had COVID. So that was like the first thing where it was like, what the fuck? Then it was like immediately, this is all like within like 3 hours. And Jonathan, remember this. It's like then it was like Tom Hanks has COVID. It was like, what the fuck? And it's like, this is getting crazy. And then, like, Donald Trump came on and addressed the country and fucking just said a lot of crazy shit and left everyone kind of feeling, like, and worse, like, more terrified. So it was like, this was all happened within one day. It was like March 11th was kind of the, ironically, like 9-11, like 3-11 was like the ground zero of COVID. That's what it was like. Okay, all this shit they've been talking about, this is real now. This is really going to be a serious problem. So it's kind of fortuitous, this episode is going to be coming to people on March 13th, so pretty much the four-year anniversary of when all this shit really got serious for everybody. So the timing couldn't have worked out any better. And, of course, as people may have discerned from my long and rambling introduction here, you know, we're going to be getting into COVID. We're going to be getting into Donald Trump. So if those are triggering for you people who are listening, you know, fucking either endure it and learn something and enlighten yourself to this, or come back next week when we got Josh Cutchin talking about near-death experiences in Bigfoot. Whatever you want to do. So it's all good. But for the people who really – I'm dying to get into this. And so let's get into it. Jonathan Vankin, thank you so much for coming on Banal of America. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. This is great. Thanks for saying all those nice things and for reading the book.
Oh, absolutely, man. I devoured this. And it was I think you even kind of say, like, in the book, it is like – it's like maddening. Because to watch how this all unfolded, and it was like having lived through it like everybody else, it was like, oh shit, I forgot about that. Oh, I forgot about when that happened. It was just like, this is nuts. But before we get into the book and the COVID and the Trump and everything, the bio, the background, you know, who is Jonathan Vankin? How did you, and I'm saying that right, Vankin?
Yeah.
Okay. And how did you, you know, tell me about sort of like, because you wrote a couple of books on conspiracies before you
did
this. So sort of just take me through sort of the bio, the background, what led up to this book.
Wow. Yeah. Well, this one's my fourth fourth nonfiction book. I've got another one coming out in, well, any day now, really. I'm not sure exactly when. But this is my fourth one. Came out in 2021. I wrote it during 2020, during when everything was going on. So it was sort of like writing history in real time. But yeah, I mean, quite a while ago, I did the book called Conspiracies, Cover-Ups, and Crimes, which was, you know, I like to say, and I think I'm correct about this, that it was really the first sort of journalistic look at the I guess what you'd call the conspiracist or conspiracy theory underground in America mm-hmm. and the world, but primarily America. I hadn't ever, when I did it, I hadn't really seen anybody do this before or treat this sort of subculture as something that should be reported on and explored and, you know, to try to see, like, these people have anything to say. And so I did that, and it was, you know, quite an experience. And yeah. I followed that one up with, I interviewed so many people, and some of them aren't with us any longer, like John Judge. I always really liked him, real sort of disciple of Mabe Russell, who just passed away right before I started working on the book. So I didn't even know that. And I called her or tried to call her and got her family and was told that she had died. But I still managed to write a chapter about her, such an interesting person and really the real innovator of this whole field, if you can call it that. So you know, I felt like that book was, well, I think history has proved it was way ahead of its time. And things have changed so much since then, since that book came out in 1991. So, you know, when I wrote it, I sort of felt like this whole way of looking at things, this sort of conspiratorial worldview, wasn't that I subscribed to it exactly, but I felt like it was a legitimately kind of subversive way of looking at the world and like a way that might be a way of sort of puncturing the sort of consensus reality that we're all fed, and it's kind of anti-propaganda. But now it seems like it's changed a lot, just mainly in the last probably 10 years or so, or even more than that, where conspiracy theories have become like a tool of propaganda and a tool of the sort of power establishment, and are used to manipulate people in ways that they really weren't before, because they were kind of pushed to the side and excluded. Yeah, very much marginalized, excluded from the mainstream, and now they've kind of become the mainstream. It's like our whole system, our whole kind of media filter system has failed, and it's let people like Trump and his followers, you know, who are basically, you know, 20, 30 years ago when I was writing that book, would have just been considered wackos, and maybe the type of wackos I might have even wanted to interview and talk about.
Right,
And now they're just dangerous wackos, so very dangerous. But they're using this same type of thinking in ways that I think are kind of nefarious. And the other way I think conspiracy theorizing has changed is that most of the people I interviewed back then and talked to were real researchers. Like, you can say their conclusions were out there or weird or wrong, and often they probably were, but they put a lot of work into it. You know, and now that's not the case. Now it's just become a way of thinking, like a reflex, a mode where people, you have so many people who just respond to any public event, anything they like or don't like, by assuming it fits into some sort of conspiratorial template. Whereas those guys like Judge and Mabe Russell, and so many other people who I talked about in that earlier book, you know, they were really trying to figure it out. They were consuming mass amounts of information, trying to piece things together. And, you know, I really admired that. Even if the conclusions they came to were often like way off the mark, I felt like sometimes maybe they were way off the mark, but maybe not quite as much off the mark as, you know, we might think. So
yeah.
I found it really interesting. Whereas now it's like, it's not like that anymore. They're just propaganda, and it's really distressing to me, and kind of I think destructive and dangerous. So I can look back and I think, you know, was I responsible for this in any way? In any tiny way? Not that my book was a huge bestseller or anything, but people did read it at the time, and I just sometimes wonder, like, did I cause this that's happening? And even at a time I participated, but I don't know. Well, I don't think so, but
I think you're in the clear on that. But
yeah, I hope so. I hope
yeah.
so.
Well, I don't know if you saw it. There's an interesting article that was in the New York Times magazine, maybe, I think, or something. There's someone who's doing a book or a movie about this. Smiles Lewis. I don't know if you know Smiles Lewis. Mm-hmm. From Texas, from Austin. He's like big in the conspiracy culture. Ken Thomas was featured in the article too. It was sort of about how all the old time conspiracy folks are dipping out of this. How they're like, I'm out. Like, this isn't this isn't what we were doing in the 80s and the 90s. And you know, even post 9/11, like this is not what we signed up for here in the conspiracy community. So your classic conspiracy theorist, like Ken Thomas, God rest his soul, by the time he passed away, he was just like, he's like, nah, this is fucking way off of what we were all about.
Yeah, he really, he was. And, you know, I love Ken. Ken was fantastic and he really helped me with some things and gave me exposure in his magazines. He was great. But yeah, you know, he actually had me write a blurb for his book, Trumpocalypse Now, I think it was.
Yeah, called. We had him on when it came out. Yeah.
Which I thought was great, and I thought his take was fantastic. His, you know, I think the subtitle was The Rise of the Conspiracy Spectacle. So he was kind of treating conspiracy theory now as part of this kind of Guy Debordian like situationist take on the spectacle. It's sort of become this thing that we consume, you know, it's not something that we create anymore. It's something that we consume.
Right.
It's part of this veneer of illusion that we all need to live in order to be part of this giant system. And we need to break out of it. In my opinion, but for the system to function, we have to all be part of this spectacle. And I thought that was a great insight on Ken's part. So I miss him a lot. He's fantastic.
Yeah, he was the man. He was definitely the man. Now the book, Close to Zero, you make a point that like you purposely sort of spelled out this subtitle to sort of get the thesis across, which is how Donald Trump fulfilled his apocalyptic vision and paid his debt to Putin with a devastating biological warfare attack on America. That's essentially the thesis of the book, which
basically, stated very bluntly.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But it's like, all right, you know what you're going to get when you get the.
Yeah. That was my idea, was like with the subtitle to just sort of tell people exactly what it was going to be and hopefully get some attention for it, you know. But I think it got a little frozen out. Like I couldn't really get people to review it. I mean, it was really weird what happened, but it did sell and I'm glad and, you know. Even made a tiny little bit of money off it, which was cool. But yeah, it was like, I think I always felt like it should have gotten more attention because, you know, I think my thesis in the book, which was essentially that the way Trump handled the pandemic, this terrible way he handled the pandemic, very destructive way, was something he kind of did on purpose. And, you know, I mean, it was usually treated as like, oh, he's this idiot, he's this moron who's just blundering his way through it. You know, I can't say there's no truth to that. He obviously, you know, is in some ways those things. But I just looking at it, I just kept thinking over and over again. It's like, well, why is he doing this? Why would he do these things that he's doing? Why was he taking steps to make this thing worse? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you can only think like he's got to be doing this on purpose for some reason. And I think the reason manifested itself probably on January 6th, but even before that, because somewhere along the line, he realized that this was a way to kind of scare people off from voting other than the people who he could control. And, you know, it almost worked.
Yeah, it was, as I said, it's maddening sort of reading the book because it brings you back to that time of 2020 when it was like every sort of move that the federal government made was antithetical to what like was in the best interests of the country as far as fighting this pandemic. And it was really, you lay it out amazingly in the book. It's like from the very beginning where they're like, they don't, first he's just calling it a hoax and sort of like saying it's no big deal. But then we find out later he knew it was a really bad situation. So it's like, that's kind of the tip off right there that like, all right, like something really super shady is going on here.
Exactly. Like he knew from the start, as in the famous, you know, quickly famous Bob Woodward tapes. He knew right away what was going on and how terrible this was. And yet he was up there in public telling people that it wasn't.
Yeah.
And then, you know, his excuse was like, well, I didn't want to cause a panic. But his entire political career is based on causing panics.
Yeah.
I mean, he has no compunctions about causing a panic. So that to me struck me as another one of his infinite number of lies, you know, disingenuous at best.
Yeah, well, it's like really interesting because it's like he, in a way, like the country was already kind of split, but he like split the country by sort of keeping his people, his fans, his supporters or whatever, like pushing them further towards just fucking not worrying about the thing, not wearing masks, like all that shit. Like, I just couldn't believe it at the time. I'm like, just wear a mask. Like, what the fuck is the big deal? But he instituted, like, he like imbued this, you know, anti-endorsement or whatever. It was like, as soon as he was like, fuck masks, it was like, then you had half the country who were like, not going to wear masks. It's like,
I know.
So it's weird because it was like he, on the one side, he played it down to like those people. But by virtue of playing it down to those people, I think a lot of us who were kind of aware and not fans of him in the first place, we were panicking. We were like, okay, this is not only is there a pandemic, but the fucking government's not going to do shit to help us. So it was a double, like, it was like a double whammy. It was crazy.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, I mean, I was worried. I was worried more, you know, I've got, you know, my mom is doing great, but she's in her 90s. And at the time, I guess she was in her late 80s. But it's like, you know, I'm worried about her. It's in that very vulnerable demographic, that age group. And I wasn't as much worried about myself, but I was a bit worried about myself and my wife. So, you know, it just was. And then to see him up there, you know, telling people, oh, you know, I want to see the churches crowded on Easter and all this stuff.
Yeah.
It's like you're out of your goddamn mind. So.
Right. Yeah. There's all kinds of people need to read the book if they can, you know, they got to read the book anyway, because we'll kind of get into this as we go along. We're not out of the woods yet with this fucking guy. So
no, you know, probably, you know, we're going back into the woods, unfortunately, which is scary.
Yeah.
Because it'll probably be worse this time around. You know, I remember the first time around, the whole time, I think a lot of us were just waiting and sort of fearing, like, well, what if there's a real crisis? Like, how is this idiot going to handle it, this deranged psychopath? And then we found out, you know. And, could have been worse, I suppose. I think one of the, you know, I always thought one of the problems with COVID in terms of the public reaction to it was that it was sort of real bad, but not quite bad enough. Like, if it was Ebola, I think you would have seen a very different reaction. You
know, people were
dropping dead on the streets.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was like the bubonic plague or something. But it was sort of, it was just bad enough that you could kind of pretend it wasn't happening. Or that it was, quote unquote, just a cold, or that it only affected old people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, so if just the nature of the virus could play it into his hands in that way. And
I knew people that were like, oh, I don't know anyone that's died of it, so it can't be that bad. That was like
exactly. Figure. Yeah, you'd hear that a lot. I mean, I did know people who died of it, but.
So did I,
Yeah, I think most people did, but not everybody. And then when people would, they were old, they were going to die anyways. If somehow that makes it okay, it's ridiculous.
Yeah,
I mean, that was one other thing that really upset me. It was like how this really, it really laid bare what the low value we place on the lives of, you know, the elderly and people who've been around for a while, who we really should be valuing and, you know, seeking their wisdom and treating them as real valuable special individuals. And instead it was like, yeah, it's okay if they die. It's all right. They're going to die anyway. I news for you. We're all going to die anyway, but that doesn't mean we should hasten the process for ourselves or anybody else. So.
Anyway. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that was like, I think that crazy ass Lieutenant Governor of Texas said something like that, where he's like, you got to reopen the country. And if some grandparents have to die, then, you know, that's their, they'll make the ultimate sacrifice for the economy and shit. It's like, dude, fuck you. Like, well, that's someone's grandma.
It was exactly. And just the amount of insane things that not just Trump, but so many people of that ilk were saying and doing was really tough to take. And it's still tough to take. I mean, it hasn't, you know, the pandemic has more or less receded and, you know, it's still out there, obviously, but it's not what it was. And, you know, but the mentality that it spawned is very much alive. And that's what's really kind of frightening, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And it's, for me, I'm here in Boston, Massachusetts. So it's like,
oh, cool.
We got crushed right away. So I think my perspective on it was really like, I was just kind of like looking at these other parts of the country that hadn't really got it yet. And it was like, dude, you guys are going to get fucking crushed. Like, it's going to come for you guys next. Like, because New York, New England, Massachusetts, we really got like waylaid right at the very beginning. And it was like, holy shit, this is really serious. And it really kind of was a wake up call too. I think that's really partially why the book resonated with me, because like right away I was like, well, we're kind of fucked. Like no one's coming to help us on this. So like we were like in the super high death tolls right away. And it was like, okay, no one's doing anything to stop this. And apparently they think it, and then you come to find out later that, you know, Kushner's putting together this testing program or whatever. And then he's like, well, it's only affecting the blue states. So we'll fuck them. And it's like, bro, what, like, what kind of a sick, like sick fucking perspective is that?
They were, yeah, it was really the country being run by a bunch of really sick, deranged individuals.
Yeah.
It was one in particular, but all of them really.
Yeah. One at the top, but it's really, it was interesting. Yeah. They just followed lockstep. Nobody, you know, it was crazy. I look back on it now and it's just like, I cannot believe some of the shit that went on. I remember like, I think the New England Patriots had to like secretly get PPE and like secretly fly it Massachusetts because to avoid FEMA, who were like taking the fucking supplies. It was like, what the fuck is going on here?
That was also really weird. I think I talk about that in the book too.
Yes,
that,
it's like, in the book. Like, yeah.
Yeah. That they're somehow confiscating all these supplies and stockpiling them, and then get Kushner going like, oh, these are our supplies. They're not your supply. It's like, they're the government's. They're supposed to belong to the people, but whatever. I mean, you just, oh, yeah, it was an awful time. And it's, you know, but the other thing that's been distressing to me is how it's been really memory hold. You know,
For sure. Yeah.
And especially, you know, you hear now, like, you know, all these Republicans going like, well, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? I'd say like,
yeah,
I'm a lot better off now than I was 4 years ago. 4 years ago, there was a global pandemic and it was terrible in this country and it didn't have to be that bad. I mean, I always think, you know, sort of the underlying thesis of the book is it didn't have to be that bad here. It was always going to be bad. I mean, it was a brand new virus, and that's going to cause a lot of problems, but it didn't have to be as bad as it was. And, you know, it was really just because of what Donald Trump and his administration did that it, you know, killed over a million people, well over a million people. I mean,
yeah, well, I was thinking about that as I was reading the book too. It's like, it has been memory hold, and it's like weirdly, it's like been overwritten by January 6th almost. It's like people are kind of really hung up on January 6th, rightfully so. Yeah. But it's just weirdly like no one can go back further than January 6th and be like, well, what about the whole year leading up to that when he fucked up the whole pandemic? Like, why is no one, how has there been no accounting of any of that shit? That's the crazy part.
I know, it's interesting. There's never been like accountability. There's never been like a commission to really invest. I mean, maybe there has been somewhere, but nothing like there was like the January 6th committee or anything like that.
Right.
And there really should be. It's like someone, you know, he and others need to be held accountable for this incredible disaster that they caused. Yeah. And but I think, you know, I think because it was a disease that a lot of people have just found it in themselves to think of it as just a natural disaster, like an earthquake or something.
Right, you know? Right.
But I mean, yes, it was that, but it didn't have to be quite like it was, anywhere near right. like it was. It just didn't. So, yeah.
Well, one of the key moments, I guess you could say, that you keep going back to in the book is this 12/29, December 29th phone call Putin
yes.
makes to Trump.
Yes.
Where Trump, like, fucking stops in the middle of a golf game.
I know.
He, like, runs off. He's, like, such a bitch. It's like, dude, like, I already have no respect for the fucking guy, but it's like, I hadn't heard about that story. And then I'm reading it in the book and I'm like, what? Again, I'm like, what a fucking bitch. Like, he just, I gotta run and go talk to Putin now about, and you sort of make the, no one really knows what they talked about, but you sort of put forward the idea that, like, okay, China had just kind of figured out this happened and announced it like a couple of days earlier. And you kind of put forward the idea, or a couple of days later they announced it.
A couple days later, yeah. My thesis, and I don't, you know, my theory, I should say,
right.
is that, and again, I can't prove it, but they had to have talked about this. I just really feel that they had to. And, you know, the story was that it was about some sort of terrorism thing, and Putin was thanking Trump for his help in stopping some sort of Chechen terrorist attack or something like that. Maybe so. I mean, there was such a thing, but at the same, did he really have to call him on the golf course on December 29th to tell him that? And then, to me, just even more suspicious, just as or even more suspicious, was the fact that he kept talking to Putin over and over again.
Right.
I think it was like, I forget the exact numbers, I don't have the book in front of me, but I think it was like 9 times in the first like 4 or 5 months of the pandemic.
Yeah.
He's talking to Putin on the phone. And, you know, maybe people don't realize, but for two world leaders to talk to each other that frequently is really, really unusual. Like, it's usually a big deal when, like, the head of one major country talks to the head of another. It's like, it's a big deal. You don't just pick up the phone and call. But he wasn't doing that with other world leaders. He wasn't talking to whoever the prime minister of Great Britain was at the time. I don't even remember who that was. It's so crazy.
Yeah,
over there.
Like
Four or five prime ministers ago. Yeah, he wasn't talking to Justin Trudeau that often. He was only talking to Vladimir Putin over and over again. Why?
Right.
Why? And that's a question I've never seen anyone really try to answer. It's like, why did he have to talk to Putin? And it's just sort of written off, oh, you know, he's in love with him or some sort of man crush or something. But something's going on there. You don't do that. I mean, I just feel Putin was basically telling him what to do.
Right, right. Well, that's kind of to extend your thesis or theory or whatever further. You make the point, because I never looked into it, and I learned this reading the book, was like that Putin essentially handled the coronavirus, the COVID, the Trump and Kuba kind of mirrored each other in a way.
Basically, like, basically.
They both
very, very, very similar.
Had this like downplay it, pretend like it's no big deal. You know, you make the point that Trump kept saying, let it wash over America. And it's like this completely fucked up perspective. Like, let's just let everybody get it, and then we'll all move on. It's like, bro, come on.
Like, no, really. It's like, yeah, I remember that. Wash over America. That was his big phrase.
Yeah, but they mirrored, they had the same kind of strategies, which is like very suspect.
Yeah, very suspect. And even, you know, and Putin even in his usual fashion took it further when you had all these doctors who were working on one aspect or another of it, like 4 or 5 of them suddenly, you know, fall out of windows.
Yeah.
And either die or be maimed. So, yeah. But yeah, it was very similar and it was weird. And it just, you know, again, it's a theory I have in the book. I can't nail it down and nobody can nail it down so far.
Right, right.
They had to have been talking about this. I'll never believe that they weren't talking about it in that multiple phone calls, which there's no reason for them to have done other than that, really.
Right, exactly, yeah. And it's like, even if he was calling about the terrorist thing, like the subject of this about-to-blossom pandemic wouldn't have come up, like he wouldn't have been like, oh, hey, by the way, like you make a point, again, I, you know, it's just one of those things, like maybe I should have learned and high school or whatever. Apparently, China and Russia share an enormous fucking border.
Yeah,
it's like,
huge.
Clearly, and Russia has intelligence people and shit. Clearly, they would have known what the fuck was going on. So,
stands to
reason it would have come up in conversation. Like, oh, hey, by the way, there's this crazy fucking pandemic that's percolating in China. So,
Yeah, you know? to me, it's not plausible that the Russians didn't know about it. Because as you say, I mean, I think it might be the longest border in the world. It's a huge border between.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're sort of trying to be more simpatico now, China and Russia, but historically they're rivals and enemies. And so of course they're spying on each other. And of course the Russians would know that this had happened even before the Chinese had publicized what it was. So, yeah, it all kind of fits together for me. And I would love to see, you know, again, I don't want it to be a conspiracy theory. I would just like somebody to investigate it, someone with far more resources than I have, like the Congress or, you know, something on that level to really find out what was going on.
Yeah, well, I was wondering about this. You mentioned it in the book, and I recall this from the impeachment and everything, the secret server that they kept the conversations, you know,
yes.
Particularly important conversations that they want to keep super secret. They would keep on a secret server. Now, just, you may not know this, but like, okay, so Biden's the president now. Does his people, do they have access to this secret server? Or is it like something that when the Trump presidency ended, they were like, all right, password protect that fucking thing and don't let anyone get into that?
That's a real good question. But I think that I would guess they probably do have access to it.
Yeah.
And but I think as we've seen, you know, the general outlook of the Biden administration has been to, quote unquote, look forward, not back.
Yeah, yeah.
So Trump has not been held accountable. I mean, now he's indicted for these 91 felony counts, but like that should have happened years ago. It's just nuts that this guy who incited this riot, this deadly riot and insurrection, just walking around free for years.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to mention all the other crimes that he quite apparently committed.
Right, so, right. Yeah. Because that's, to me, like the most mystifying part of it, because we talk about, because I remember like they had the meeting, him and Putin, and I think fucking Trump like tore up the notes and shit. And it was just like, how do we not know? Maybe like in 50 years or something, we'll find out what the fuck these conversations like. But it's just amazing to me that like we still don't know what these two were talking about on these calls, in these meetings and shit. And it's just like, that's super suspicious to me.
Yeah. And it just blows my mind that like, it feels like most people who are in a position to find out just kind of shrug. It's like, well, you know, just kind of the way it was. Moving on.
Yeah. 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 It's very unsettling. And talk a little bit about the apocalyptic vision of Donald Trump.
Yeah,
he sort of has this fetish for chaos and destruction.
He really does, and I think this is a very underpublicized thing aspect of his character, which is that he's fascinated by violence, and particularly mass violence. And there's something about it that really attracts him. And he's got, and I document in the book in chapter 2. This whole history of these apocalyptic statements that he's made. And it even goes back to when he was growing up. I mean, he belonged to sort of like a cult-ish organization, which was actually this church of Norman Vincent Peale, the Power of Positive Thinking guy. And, you know, he grew up in this very sort of cultic atmosphere. And that's something you don't hear about often about him either. And I don't know if that's connected to his fascination with violence. I think he just has a personality disorder. But he clearly is sort of in love with the idea of just mass destruction. And I give a whole bunch of quotes in there from him going back to the 80s when he talks about how, you know, when society falls apart, he's going to benefit and how great it'll be. And, you know, how like the only way to really sort of deal with social problems is just kind of set everything on fire. You know,
and
he seems to really believe that. And in a way, I think that at least prior to the pandemic, we were very lucky in those first 4 years, and hopefully there won't be another 4 years, but at least those first 4 years, that he never really got the chance to do that. He tried, like, during the whole George Floyd summer, which was also during the pandemic.
Right.
Crazy year, 2020. It's like, it's just nuts that people look back on that, or they try to make you look back on it and say, oh, we were so much better then. It's like,
No, that was
pretty bad.
That was an intense fucking year. Yeah, that was intense.
And, And he's like wanting to turn the troops on people, and now he's even said that he will do that. I mean, that's sort of part of his agenda for his second term, is like to quell political protest with the military. I mean, if this is what people are going to vote for, this is the guy who's leading in the polls because Biden is quote unquote too old. I mean, it's just, I feel like everyone's brain was broken by the pandemic and it hasn't healed yet.
Yeah, this is interesting too. Well, one point, just as a sort of like as an anecdotal thing to the what we're just talking about, it's like the guy's whole fucking perspective could best be summed up after 9/11 happened, when he was like, "Now I have the tallest building in New York."
Exactly.
It was like, yeah, bro, like he's kind of fucking asshole. Like, what guy? Who the fuck says that? Who the, you know? Shit.
He's a very strange person, and not in a good way.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And you talk about it breaking people's brains. I think, there's a whole sort of interesting phenomenon that happened when, because everybody got locked down, and then you saw a lot of this conspiracy shit kind of like seep into the lockdown. That's when the plandemic shit happened.
Yeah.
I knew a lot of people like that were, quote, or I thought they were normal people, people I went to high school with, or people I went to college with, or like neighbors or something like that. And it was like, oh, okay, Freddie thinks the pandemic is a grand fucking scheme to keep everybody locked down or whatever. It was like, holy shit, people lost their fucking minds.
They really did. They really did. And I think a lot of that, it comes from the top. I mean, Trump was always that way.
Right.
Before this. So the pump was sort of primed for people to be like, oh, this is the deep state. This is the whatever, all the bad guys who just want to take down Trump. And this is them doing that. And yeah.
Right.
It was nuts. And people just seemed to go completely crazy. And I don't feel like they've recovered.
Oh, no, not at all. No.
No. Like, we're still in the middle of that part of it. And it's frustrating, frankly, for me. But that, that's why I wrote the book back in 2020, was that it was almost like therapy for myself, because it was just, I just felt like, God, I got to do something. But what can I do? Take my one skill in life, which is writing and research. and it's basically what I'm more or less good at. And let's do that. So that's what I did. And that's where the book came from.
Right.
So, you asked me before, like, what led up to it? Well, it was sort of that's basically it. That's why I did it, was to get all this stuff out there and to document this all, this whole phenomenon. In addition to trying to present the idea that maybe there was more to this on Trump's part, that he was really kind of doing this on purpose for his own political and personal ends. But also let's just get this out there and die. And I think I did a fairly good job of documenting the whole thing. And, it's like if you have memory hold this and you don't really remember what it was like, I think reading this book will take you back.
Yeah.
And you'll remember what was really going on back then. Cause like I said, I wrote it all in real time. I mean, I think I wrote it between about maybe April and November of that year. And then I wrote a little bit late. I wrote this postscript after January 6th. So, it was all happening as I was writing it.
Yeah, and people should go back and read it, because I think a lot of us kind of have, I don't know if intentionally memory hold it, or just kind of like, you just kind of want to move on from that tumultuous, crazy fucking year. Yeah. And it's like, it's been long enough. This election's coming up. If you're not sure who to vote for by now, folks, read this fucking book, and it should be pretty clear to you that we do not want to fucking live through this situation again. And that's an interesting part you bring up in the book, too, is that Trump, like, it would seem to go against his better interests. He did everything not just against the better interests of the country, but it would seem as if it was going against his best interests as far as getting reelected went, because it was like, dude, you are fucking this up so badly that I don't see how anyone can vote for this guy after this, in November, because who the fuck knows when this thing's going to be over. That was kind of the thinking at the time. And that was like the really, you try to get into this guy's head, like, why is he fucking this up so badly? And And it's like, doesn't he want to get reelected? And it kind of raises the question of, like, maybe he thought that messing up the response was the better way to would assure that he could get elected. I mean, at one point he did kind of tease not even having an election.
Yeah, and I think that he did think that. And I think that when you look at the way he's run every campaign that he's run, he's on his third one now, I guess, for president. Well, there was actually one in 2020, but it didn't go very far. But in terms of this time around, you know, he ran 2016, 2020, and now, he's never really tried to win over new voters. And that's right. The way, you know, traditionally campaigns are run. You try, you know, you have your base, you can count on them. You want to keep them happy, but you can count on them. And then you have a certain group of people who are persuadable, and you try to expand your base and bring them into your fold. He never tries to do that. He never tries to convince anybody, persuade anybody. He only just tries to bully people. And I think what he was doing here was trying to essentially exclude anyone from voting who wasn't going to vote for him. And I think he knew that by scaring everybody, except put it this way. He knew everybody was scared, but what he was trying to do was convince at least the people who were listening to him that this was all phony, it was a hoax, it was no big deal. So you just go out and vote, and knowing that the rest of the sane people probably were going to be very reluctant to march down to the polls. But then this whole thing with the expanded mail-in voting came along, and so he just fought and fought and fought against that. Maybe he didn't anticipate that that was going to spread as much as it did, and is still in place in a lot of, I mean, here in California, you know, it's pretty much all mail-in voting. I mean, yeah. You know, some people, you can go to the polls if you want to, but basically everything is done with these mail-in ballots, and it's fine, it's great, and it's easy, and I like it, frankly. But I think, you know, I think he understood that he could, his people would do what he told them to do, and right. They would go out and vote and whatever, no matter what, wouldn't care. But other people were going to be scared. And so he'd win. At least that's what he thought. Seems kind of stupid, but there you have it. I think, yeah, you know, yeah. And I think, but it is amazing when you think about it. You think like, man, all you had to do was just do the right thing. And you would have been a hero. You know, even the people who couldn't stand you, like people like me who really couldn't stand you in the first place. If he had just gone and like done the right thing, and treated this as with the seriousness it deserved, I'd have to say, well, you know, okay.
Yeah, you'd have to begrudgingly respect him. You'd be they did a good job on that. I can't fault them for that. They managed to.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But he did the exact opposite thing. So he basically continued to be the person he was. And we never should have expected him to do anything different because people, especially people like that, don't really change. They're going to keep being who they are, maybe more so. So, you know, in a way it was predictable, but at the same time, it was just, you know, it was terrible. And he certainly doesn't deserve a chance to do it again because it could only get worse the next time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was, yeah, that was one of the more mystifying parts of it for sure. Because, like, yeah, it was, like I said, you'd have to be like, all right, well, good job on that, I guess. I can't really fault him for that. But it was just one ridiculous fucking thing after another, and it was crazy. Now, you also make an interesting point in the book about how this, you know, the country shut down, then they're like, we got to reopen the country, and then these sort of like phony protests like sprung up that seemed like they were grassroots, but it turns out they were sort of orchestrated by different sort of groups and online agitators, if you will.
Yeah, they were all very organized, and I think you saw, like, you know, I don't remember exactly, there were certain money groups behind them, but a lot of it was these people, these sort of Proud Boy types, and these kind of like right wing kind of neo-fascist, I don't know what you call them, but sort of neo-fascist kind of thuggish groups that you saw on January 6th too. And yeah, some of them have since had to go to jail for actually being convicted of insurrection, but seditious conspiracy, I think, was the charge against some of them. And they've been going to jail for significant periods of time. And, they were behind these same things. So it was, in a way, it was all kind of a run-up to January 6th. I don't know if it was planned that way, but it worked out that way. That all these pro and the yeah, but was it Michigan? There was a big protest at the state house.
Yes.
You can't even call it a protest. It was really like an insurrection, basically, where all these sort of armed fools showed up and were chanting and waving guns around. And
And as this was happening, you point out in the book, like, I think also people forget because Trump's not on Twitter anymore. So you just, I mean, his shit from Truth Social, whatever, it's reposted on it. So it's, but it's not the same.
It's just not the same.
Thank God, because it's like Twitter's fucking bad enough now. I don't want to do that. But people forget that it was like he would just fuck. He tweeted this shit like liberate Michigan, liberate Virginia, and shit. And it was like just throwing fuel on the fire of this discontent and shit. Instead of being like, hey, everybody, we got to calm down. Da, 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 da. He was never a calming influence.
Never. Like I said before, it's like his whole political career is based on creating panic. So when he gets up there and says, oh, well, I just didn't want to cause a panic, it's like that's quite an obvious lie. Like when has he never not wanted to cause a panic? He always wants to cause a panic. So, yeah, and the whole liberate Michigan, liberate this, it's like, again, very deliberate. I mean, he's sitting there actually typing those things or whatever you do on your phone. So yeah, he knows what he's doing. You know, he's not that dumb. And that's what, again, to me, makes me feel like, hey, this whole country was the victim of this guy's insanity and whatever was going on between him and Putin and his just general predilection to want to cause a lot of destruction because he feels he benefits from it and he sort of enjoys it.
Yeah, and what's kind of fucking maddening to me is just how everybody in the GOP is just kind of like falling into lockstep behind him. And it's like in a different time, they would have just drummed this guy out. Like I never even understood like how they all just kind of went along with him in the fucking first, like, you know, it was kind of, everybody just missed him until he got the nomination in 2016. Yeah. Then they all just kind of fell into lockstep. But there's part of me that, not to get too conspiratorial, but there's a part of me that definitely fucking thinks that, look, they hacked into the Democratic servers and all that shit. They blew all that shit out into the world. And it's part of me that's just like, they probably did the same thing to the fucking Republicans. And they were like, look, you're going to play ball with us, or we're going to roll all your shit out. You know?
It's not out of the realm of possibility. I think it's possible. But yeah, and that whole thing too was like, again, it's just one of those things that's been memory hold. The fact that he was colluding with Russia. There's no doubt about that. I mean, it's obvious. And just because the Mueller report didn't nail it down, it's in there and it's everywhere else. And you know, one thing that did come out from the Mueller investigation, well, many, many things came out. One thing that I loved most was like his famous moment, Trump's famous moment where he says, you know, the Russia, are you listening moment? Russia, if you're listening, you know, I hope you find Hillary Clinton's emails or whatever. And within hours, it turned out, the Mueller investigation found, within hours after he made that statement, they're in there trying to hack into these various servers owned by her, or the one that she accessed. You know, they're trying to basically just took orders from him and trying to do what he said. Yeah. So the idea that somehow there was no collusion is just absurd.
Yeah. It's really crazy, and it's just troubling too because we've gone so deep into this now. We're like, we're 8 years into this, or nine really, because the election kind of started in 2015 really when it all kind of kicked off. But it's like, so just deep, these people are more and more imbued into the cult now. Like you can't get them out. Like you watch these fucking things now where they interview the voters and shit, and they are just so far gone. And it's like, I don't know how you can even talk to these people, work with these people, bring them in, you know, into some sort of, like, we just had a show on with Steven Snyder talking about, like, the shattering of reality. It's like we have no shared reality anymore. It's and a big part of it is this sort of weird MAGA cult that's emerged.
Yeah, and I think that's a big problem, you know? I mean, on the one hand, it's like you don't want – I mean, like I said, when I went back and wrote my first book, it was sort of a reaction against this consensus reality. But I think there's a difference between like this imposed consensus reality and just a shared set of facts, you know, that, we should be operating from, that are relatively objective, you know, that shouldn't really be in dispute. And we don't have those anymore. We have like half the country or whatever it is, 40-some percent, basically denying anything that's actually real. And if it doesn't serve the purpose of their, you know, their great leader. So it's very, it's very upsetting.
Yeah, and you made a really good point in the book, too, the, that, like, when they were all kind of, when the politicians were all, like, arguing about the economy and shit, what to do about it, and stimulus, and extra money for people and everything, you know, you made a good point that it exposed how fucked up the economic system we have is. And you say it, that maybe it's not so good to have an economic system that needs propping up by coercion, which I thought was just a really great observation, because it is like, it is pretty much that. It's like, once you're old enough to fucking work, you pretty much have to work. Like, you have you're in the system.
Yeah, and it was like, you know, I remember all these, at the time, there was all this stuff about, oh, people are making more from this unemployment, and then, you know, from the supplemental unemployment and the stimulus, but they're making more than they would if they worked a job. It's like, What does that tell you? Like, sit and think about that statement for a minute. It's like, it's like, so you basically, your typical job these people are thinking of basically pays nothing and doesn't provide you with anything, you know, other than a subsistence wage and a minimal, you know, minimal survival. Like, how is that a way to live?
Right. You
know, what kind of system is that? Like, why can't we have a system that actually gives people halfway decent lives, you know? And so you can build on that and become a better person and have a better society and all these idealistic things that I like to talk about sometimes. But they're just not possible the way our system is set up. And I think that's a whole other topic, and it's fascinating. But I think that the pandemic and the attendant economic support programs that came with it really kind of exposed all that.
And, oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, and I see, actually wrote a story about it for the publication that I was working for just not too long ago about how, focused mainly on California, but it applies to the whole country, that we really sort of set up, very briefly, a kind of European-style social democracy, you know, where there's sort of a difference, I think, between what you call liberal democracy, which doesn't necessarily mean liberal in the sense people think of, but more like liberal in the sense of it's focused on personal freedoms and economic freedoms, and you don't regulate business. And so kind of what a lot of people call neoliberal, it's similar. And then you have social democracy, which is more oriented towards improving people's lives and more oriented towards equity, like making sure everyone gets a fair shake. And maybe there's more regulations, maybe there's some more restrictions on personal conduct in some aspects of your economic life anyway, but basically it's geared towards creating a basic more than subsistence level of existence for people. Like, people could actually theoretically thrive under this system. And we set that up for a little while, and then we just got rid of it. Yeah. And we saw the results where, you know, poverty was sliced by a lot, and child poverty was cut by 50% by these programs. And then we just were like, okay, we're done. We're done with that.
Yeah.
We're going back to the way it was. I mean, it's like, why?
Yeah, it was very eye-opening. The whole experience, the whole pandemic was very eye-opening. Like I said before, it was like you kind of realized, it's like that movie that came out a few months ago, the Don't Look Up movie, where it was like, you know, they kind of realized no one's going to come and fucking help you. That was the realization. If you didn't figure that out during the pandemic, I think that, you know, you got to get your head out of the sand. Like, no one's going to come and help you. And I think a lot of people, when they had all that free time, they had a lot of time to kind of think about not just sort of like what the fuck was happening, but like there was a certain, it was kind of cliche, but it's like, now I'm going to write my book. Now I'm going to learn to play guitar, or now I'm going to take up gardening. It's like people could pursue their dreams. It was really kind of, it was probably one of the few like silver linings of this whole horrible fucking ordeal, that people were like, oh, I can fucking, oh, well, you know, I've been furloughed or whatever. I'm on unemployment, so I can just do now. Maybe I can do my thing. And so that was kind of but it sort of laid bare the thing where it's like, you wouldn't be able to do this if it wasn't a pandemic. This is like this is a lucky break in a sense, like for everybody who was fortunate enough to sort of be in that position where they're twiddling their fucking thumbs waiting for the world to open up again. So it was a very eye-opening period of time in a lot of ways.
It certainly was. And there were these, I mean, I hate to say silver linings because it was such an awful thing and people suffered and died. But at the same time, we did see some possibilities of maybe how our society could be reconstructed in a way that allows people to do things like, hey, I'm going to pursue a dream and I can do it without worrying that, you know, I'm going to suffer total economic collapse and end up on the streets, you know, and people shouldn't have to worry about that. In my view, we shouldn't have to worry about that.
And, Absolutely.
But we do. And our whole society is kind of based on that. And it's based on, as you said, coercion and the fear that, you know, for most people, certainly sort of the median person, I think, you know, you're just a couple bad breaks away from total disaster.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you can kind of see that tension at work in the years since the pandemic where, like, the work from home thing. It was like all of a sudden everyone's like, oh, wait a minute. We don't actually have to fucking go in to the office. Like, there's really no need for a fucking office in the first place. Like, I just go there, I sit, and then I leave and go home. And it's like, oh, now that I don't have to drive an hour every back and forth every day, like my life is so much great. But then after the pandemic, it's like, no, you got to go back to the office. We need to go back to the office because the buildings, you know, because we rented these fucking offices and we're on a lease here and we need to justify the fucking money we're spending on all these offices and shit. These skyscrapers are in these big cities.
Yeah, exactly. But I also think it's like it's just a way of control, too, because now, you know, we have the technology available like we're using right now. You know, I'm talking to you in Boston and I'm in Los Angeles and we might as well be in the same room, basically, just talking. And that obviously wasn't possible until fairly recently. But that seems to create a lot of fear in these structures where people, you know, they need people together in one place because then you can sort of keep an eye on everyone and surveil them and control their actions. Whereas if they're dispersed all over the country, they might be doing the same work and doing it just as well, if not better, but they're doing it on their own.
Yeah.
At their own pace, not the way I, the boss, want them to do it. So,
right.
You know, again, it was one of those things that was just exposed by the pandemic and the technology that came along with it. I mean, I sometimes think like, my God, what would we have been like if this had happened 20 years earlier?
You know? Oh God. Yeah.
I mean, I remember like during the whole thing, people complaining about like Zoom and stuff like that. And like, oh my God, it's just not the same on Zoom. You know, I just have to talk to my friends on Zoom. I don't like it. And it's like, yeah, it's not the same as being in person, but come on. It's like, you gotta be kidding me. It's like, when I was growing up, it's like, not only did we not have Zoom, it's like we barely had long distance phone call. I mean, we had it obviously, but it was so prohibitively expensive.
Yes,
just couldn't really do it. You know, it's like, if you wanted to make long distance phone calls on any regular basis, you better be prepared to spend, you know, hundreds of dollars every month.
Right.
Which in today's money would be worth thousands of dollars every month on your phone bills. Whereas now, you know, as long as you subscribe to the internet, you can sit and talk for no additional charge face to face, essentially.
Yeah. No, virtually. That's great. You know? Yeah.
And so it's one of those things that I think wasn't really appreciated. Like people just wanted to sort of complain about everything. But at the same time, it's like, man, this would have been if people were sort of locked down we're never really locked down, but we were told to stay inside and all that stuff.
Right.
And if you had to do that for weeks or months at a time without all this other technology that we have and still have, boy, I don't even know what would have happened. It would have been bad.
Yeah. Well, the lockdown thing was like sort of really weird in a way because it was like you said, we weren't like locked down. I think it's a matter of someone's almost perspective. Like if it had been, again, it was like coming from the top, from Trump and everybody, they made it sound so horrifyingly bad. But it's like, look, if you just take on that responsibility yourself, then you're not locked down. Like you're like, look, I'm just going to stay in and do the right thing and not fucking go out or whatever, then no one's holding you down, man. That's just your call to fucking do the right thing. That was
exactly,
that to me
yeah, exactly.
the kind of maddening part of it all.
And it wasn't like, I think like in Europe, there were places where, you know, there were cops who were sort of patrolling and like, oh, if you went out of your neighborhood, they would force you back.
It was intense in some places.
Yeah, that didn't happen here. It's like, you could go outside, you could go to the store, you know, you may have to wear a mask maybe, whatever, but you could go places, you could do things. It wasn't like you were, you know, maybe it was better and smarter to stay in your house or your apartment as much as you could, but you didn't have to.
Right, right.
You know, you could go places that were available. I mean, places were shut down, like movie theaters and restaurants for the most part.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, there was plenty of stuff you could do if you wanted to.
Right,
so,
right. Yeah, yeah.
You know.
That was the crazy part. It was just like, yeah. I guess it's just a difference of perspective with people, you know?
I guess so. But I remember, oh, my God, we're locked down. It's like, we're not locked down.
Yeah. It's like, it's two sides of the coin. Yeah, it's like glass half empty, glass half full. It's like, oh, no, I can't go get my hair cut. It's like, hey, bro, why don't you grow your hair out? Try it.
Yeah, it's like,
it's like, hey, it'll be funny in 6 months when you have wicked long hair, dude. It'll be a riot. No one's going to judge you. It's
truly, truly first world problems.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I can't get my nails done. You know,
it's like you're not going anywhere. Why do you fucking?
I know.
Why
so,
do you care?
But like I say, it seemed to break everybody's brain. They just couldn't. It's a lot of people just couldn't deal with it. But also, as we mentioned earlier, a lot of that was manufactured dissent.
Yes, absolutely. And once you get that ball rolling on the manufacturer, then other people just join in on it. Like, they buy into it, and then their team. I mean, the line was clearly down drawn. Like, there was like a fucking mat, like you pointed out in the book, like the mask videos of like people making a fucking to do about masks and arguing about masks. The videos would come online. It was like, it just kept perpetuating the same mindset of like antagonism with each other.
Yeah. I think I even mentioned in the book, like, I sort of saw those videos, you know, you could look at them as like, oh my God, these crazy people out there. But I kind of saw those videos as propaganda in themselves.
Yeah, like, absolutely. Yeah.
It was sort of perpetuating the idea that, like, there was an argument over this. Like, it was.
Right.
Like,
right.
You know, it's like, oh, maybe you don't. Maybe it is a bad thing to have to wear a mask in public. You know, maybe it is, like, something that is just being imposed on us for no reason. And when you see those videos, a lot of people are going to have that mindset. And they're going to sympathize with the person who's like, no, I'm not going to do it. And you're not going to make me. You know,
right,
so.
Right.
Yeah. I thought that was kind of interesting too, because on one hand they were entertaining just for the lunacy of it all, but on the other hand I think they served a purpose that was, again, not good.
Yeah, well, there's definitely a certain mindset of people that are like, no one's going to tell me what to do, and it's just like, look, dude, like, don't stick your fucking finger in a light socket. That's all. Like, it's not they're not telling you what to do.
Yeah.
Because they want to control you. They're trying to make sure you don't fucking die. It's like,
yeah, exactly.
You know,
we're really just asking you to exercise common sense. If that's too much for you, I don't know what to tell you.
Right, right. But again, going back to close to zero, when you've got the fucking leader of the free world saying it's a hoax, saying it's no big deal, saying it's just going to magically go away, I can understand why his cult followers are like, just march to the beat of this fucking crazy drummer.
And that's exactly what happened. It is exactly what happened.
Now, I couldn't help but shake my fist at you a little bit at the end of the book, because you say the very like last line of the fucking book is like, the only good thing we can say about the Trump era is that it's over. And I'm like reading the fucking book last weekend and I'm like, Jonathan!
I know, I guess I spoke too soon. Well, I mean, at least he was over, but temporarily.
Right.
But he never really went away, and now he's back. And, you know, it's a weird situation. It's just everything that happened. I mean, COVID obviously being one major thing, but not the only thing.
Yeah.
You just have to think, like, how is it? Like, how is anybody even thinking of voting for this guy? Even if you're, like, a conservative and whatever, it's like, he's not a conservative. He's just a fascist lunatic. So, you know, it's mystifying to me. I think books are going to be written about this for decades and decades to come.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, we'll let the sociologists try to figure it all out. But it's just, it's baffling.
It's interesting, too, because the book, Close to Zero, folks should check it out and get it on Amazon.
Yes, please.
Is you make a point in the book, and it's important to note that all the stuff you're referencing in the book is from open public sources. This is reporting, reporting like throughout all the different, you know, all the media and everything over the, and that's awesome, obviously. But like, part of me, I just get so frustrated in a sense because the media just has completely fucked this all up. It's like, it almost seems like they're fucking complicit in whatever this is. And you mentioned, I might mess up her name, Sarah Kendzior. Yeah. She is prescient, man. And she's just kind of like, yeah, this is all a fucking rigged game, dude. And you're not even like it. So, but part, and I tend to agree with her in a lot of ways because it's like the media, they just go along with this fucking shit. And it like, the shit that you put out in Close to Zero, that should be just common fucking knowledge that this guy completely fucked this up. It should be, he should be a pariah for having stood in the way of all progress towards stopping the pandemic. But it's like nobody, nobody fucking seems to be on willing to just accept this as a fact.
No one would ask the question, like, why? Why is he acting this way? Right. Everyone just assumed they already knew the answer, you know, that he was just a dummy. But it's like, yeah, I guess he was and is, but at the same time, there was a lot more to it than that. And no one in the press, no one in the media, you know, I mean, they're all profiting from this too. It's like, look how many books came out of it. That, you know, how every single one of those reporters in the White House press room, it seems like every single one of them wrote a book and published it. So, but you know, but what I was trying to do in mine, and I'm not a White House press reporter or anything like that. I'm just an independent journalist and writer, but I was definitely trying to stick to the public record, and I did do that.
Absolutely. And
you know, I think one of the things you can say about this book is that there's nothing in there that's like some sort of anonymous source or something that you could look at and go, oh, where did that come from? It's like, it's all right there. I put 100 pages of footnotes in there. There's about 1,000 of them almost. You can look everything up for yourself. Anything that you doubt, if you're reading on the Kindle, you just can click it and it'll go right to the citation.
There you go.
There's nothing in there that is really controversial or indisputable. It's more just the way I put them together.
Yeah.
That, you know, because it's all out there. It just needs to be synthesized. And I didn't think anybody was doing that. So.
No, I don't think anyone. I mean, yours is the first book I've seen that's like, hey, this guy did this on purpose. Like, you need to look at this, what this guy did and how he handled this step by step. And you lay it out in the book. Like, he was warned for like 2 months before, you know, like 2.5 months before this infamous March 11th day we talked about at the beginning of the show. He knew about all this shit for like 2.5 months. Didn't do anything. Said it was all bullshit.
Yep.
Then it became real. And then he was like, oh, it's just going to go away. And then he's like, I don't want to test anybody because that makes it look like we have more people who have it, which is like, what the fuck? This is the most backwards logic. The whole testing thing was just completely insane to me where they're like, we don't want to test anybody because if we test people, then we'll find out that it's really bad.
Find out they have it. Yeah, it's like just out of sight, out of mind. Just pretend nobody has it and then nobody will.
Yeah. And then it's just like, oh, let's just let it fucking happen. And it was like, this is, so it's like a step by step along the way, you trace the chronology of this and how every time there was an opportunity to do the right thing or do it the beneficial way, he just fucking veered off in the opposite direction.
He did the opposite thing. Whatever was the right thing to do, he did the opposite. Like George Costanza, it was like, you know, whatever the right thing is to do, he's going to do the wrong thing. And I don't see how you can look at that and think that wasn't deliberate. Like, nobody's that dumb. I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Especially someone in that position. So, it's, and will there ever be any accountability on his part? I mean, I doubt it, but I wish there would be, because there should be. And I think that's, and not just to punish him, he certainly deserves to be punished, it's just to prevent it happening again, to make sure that we know what happened, and that the next time something like this happens, because there will be a next time, we're better, in a much better position, no matter who is occupying, you know, the White House. We're in a better position to deal with it, to handle it, and to get through it without so much carnage.
Yeah. Now, have you, you say you wrote the book sort of in real time as it was going on. The book came out in 2021. Have you learned anything new? Has any sort of new nuggets from that time period come up where you're like, okay, that adds another piece to this puzzle of what went down?
I mean, I think it's more just like, not so much specifically about COVID, I don't think, but more about just his behavior and the things that he continues to do. To me, just reinforce how deliberate this whole thing was and how in character it would be for him to do this on purpose.
Yeah.
Because you look at everything he's done since and everything that's come out about what he did before, so many things have been absolutely deliberate. Whether it was, you know, stealing all these classified documents or, you name it. It's like he comes off as sort of this lunatic and idiot who doesn't know what Pearl Harbor was and stupid things like that. And this narcissist, but he's not completely stupid. Like, he knows, he certainly has street smarts, and he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's any question of that. And this, like I said, is completely in character for him to try to manipulate events around him in the way that he feels is going to benefit him. And, like, intuitively, it seems like this wouldn't benefit him, but just to repeat what I was saying earlier, I don't think he was ever interested in winning an election the conventional way.
Yeah. You know?
By persuading people and trying to let people think, let people know that your policies are better than the other guy's. I'm going to make your life better than he will. He never tries to do that. He just rants and raves and tries to reinforce his own support and his own base and deter everybody else from participating.
Right. Yeah, it's very frustrating, and it's very worrisome. I sort of kicked, we did like an end of the year special, and it was like, right, this is probably like the last time I'm going to feel comfortable until probably like, you know, mid-November when I know how this shakes out. And even then, it's like, I don't know, you know, even if he loses in the election, it's like, well, let's just get the fucking, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, do you have any... I mean, it's sort of a fool's game to sort of speculate, but do you have any sort of feelings about where this is headed as we go forward? And again, it's like, I do want to hammer the media again. You mentioned the thing about the books coming out. There's nothing that pisses me off more than they come out with these books, and they're like, then they have all this shit that they found out, like, they knew about for, like, months. And it's like...
Exactly.
It's like, you're a fucking reporter, dude. Like, for the New York Times or the Washington Post, and you knew this shit, and you sat on it because it would be a good thing for your book, but you didn't fucking report on it at the time. Like, come on, bro. Like, you're not on our side at all. Like, not like I mean, I must be an idiot for thinking they were, but it's like, you are not a part of the fucking, you're not helping anybody with that kind of shit.
No, and like, as a journalist myself, I would like to think that there's something about the profession that is noble, but it certainly wasn't conducted that way by the people who get paid the most money to do it, that's for sure. And, you know, and the classic example was Woodward. I mean, the revelations he came out with were stunning, and I'm glad he came out with them, but he knew them at the very beginning.
Yeah,
and
real time.
Yeah, and he sat on them for months. Like, it just, I don't know, it just doesn't seem right to me. And I guess I understand the economic incentives to do that, but yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, you would think, like, how different would things have been if he fucking was like, if he turned around Woodward and was like, here's the fucking tape of this guy. Like, he just said this last night to me in a conversation.
I know. It's like, why didn't
this thing is a deadly flu and we need to get, like, things would have changed overnight, possibly. Who knows?
Yeah, well, you just have to wonder what would have happened if he had just gone in to the Washington Post that day and turned in a story saying, hey, you know, I talked to Trump last night, and he said this thing is really bad. It's going to kill a lot of people, and it's not what he's saying publicly. You know, what if the Post ran that story, and then CNN and MSNBC and all the others went with it? I don't think Fox would go with it, but the rest of them go with it. It's like, well, what, you know, maybe it would have changed things. I would like to think it would. Maybe I'm naive. I don't know. But I'd like to think that would have some effect. But that's not what happened.
So to go back to the question I had before I went off on that tangent about the media, so do you have any – I mean, I'm optimistic, I guess, is where I'm at today. On March 7th? I'm – the polling seems all fucked up. I feel like Trump has 10% at least less support than the polling is showing. So every time the votes come in, it's like he's going under where the polls are saying he is. So part of me is just like, okay, I don't trust these polls. And you say in the book, you say the great untold story of the Trump era was that Americans willingly and even gleefully elevated a deranged psychopath. And again, it's like, shit, man, we're right back. It's deja vu all over again here with this situation.
Yeah, it's deja vu all over again. And I feel like, I mean, you know, in terms of predictions, I hate to make a prediction, but
right.
I mean,
feeling, I guess, as well.
I mean, let's put it this way. I feel less optimistic than I felt in 2016. Like in 2016, I really didn't think he was going to win.
Yeah.
I thought there was a chance. I wasn't unrealistic about it, but I really didn't think it was going to happen. This time, I still don't think he's going to win, but it's looking not nearly that great right now. But yeah. I do think, like, the one thing I'm a little encouraged by is you look at all these primaries, and, yeah, he's sweeping them all, and Nikki Haley, you know, didn't really put up a great fight or anything, but he did really only get about 60% of the vote in most of those primaries. And that's, considering you're running almost unopposed, that doesn't seem like enough. Like, if only 60% of Republicans are really supporting him, time will tell, and I'm sure a lot of them will go back to voting for him, but it does seem like there might be enough Republicans, and I don't think there'll be that many, but there might be just enough to undercut his support, you know, and that's what I'm hoping.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm hopeful for, and I'm in a sense hopeful too that there'll be this. Obviously not the pandemic, but a repeat of what happened during the pandemic where he fucking, because he loves attention, he had to be on fucking TV every day.
Every day.
And he just kept saying crazier and crazier shit, and he became, and falsehoods after falsehoods, and was obviously a complete fucking dick to anybody that challenged him. And it just exposed him. I felt like he was more exposed during the pandemic to the people maybe who were like, all right, I'm not really paying attention much. And they kind of started paying attention. They saw like, okay, this guy's kind of a fucking nut.
I'm hoping that as the campaign goes along, he'll be more and more public and more people will just be turned off by his lunacy.
Yeah.
That's the hope. I mean, I can't say it's definitely going to happen, but we can hope.
Yeah, that's all you can hope for. I mean, because what's really scary to me, too, is like, back in 2016, even 2020, he was kind of barely campaigning 2020, but it was like in 2016, he came off as kind of like a rogue, normal, in a sense, policy. You know, he had policy ideas and shit. Now it's just like, I'm going to be a dictator. I'm going to come in. I'm going to fucking be a dictator. It's like this, the bloom is off the rose. It's like the mask is off, all the cliches. It's like, okay, the guy is just straight up telling you, like, if I become president again, we're going to fucking kick every, you know, I'm going to be a fascist. So
yeah, I'm going to deport 18 million people and I'm going to use the military to put down, you know, political dissent, and I'm just going to be a dictator. And it's like, and people are like, oh, all right.
So, yeah. And he makes like a big joke out of it. It's like, I'm only starting on day one or whatever. It's like,
right. Well, that's his rationale for everything. It's usually like, I'm just being sarcastic or I'm joking or I'm, he likes the word sarcastic. He'll say that over and over again for things that are not in any way, shape, or form sarcasm. But, you know, when he's caught out in one of these insane things, like, oh, I was just being sarcastic. Whatever.
Well, the one that really got me recently was where he mixed up Nikki Haley and Nancy Pelosi, and then he's like, I do that on purpose. Because – and he had this whole fucking made-up story, and it's like, bro, you just fucked up their names. Like, he can never admit he made a mistake. It's always like, I shot myself in the foot on purpose because that's part of my my style. It's what I do.
Right. I meant to do that.
Yeah. So I'm optimistic that people will kind of wake up to this, but there's that core of people. And then what are we going to do about that fucking core of people? Like, if he loses again, they're going to be so fucking bullshit. I don't want to deal with that poll.
I don't really want to deal with it either, but I'm hoping that if he loses again, or when he loses again, he'll, it'll sort of discourage a lot of them. And a lot of them will get old and pass away.
Well, I think, and I think that maybe the January 6th thing kind of was a wake-up call to some of them, where it's like, look, I'm going to get really pissed, but I'm not breaking into Congress, dude. So
right.
There's only, I'm going to rant and rave on social media, but you know.
People are actually going to jail for this.
Yeah. Because that, to me, is the other part of it, where it's just like, these people, like, a lot of them, like, sacrifice their fucking lives to, and he doesn't give a fuck. He does not give a fuck about any of these people. That's the craziest part about it. It's like, I think Howard Stern was like, he hates these people. Like, he fucking hates the people that his loyalist supports. He sneers at them, and he wouldn't even want to be in the same room as them.
No, not at all. But you hear these stories of these people who, like, you know, threw away their lives to go riot on January 6th. It's like, if you read anything about cults and the way people in cults behave, it all sounds very similar. It's very familiar.
Yeah, it's definitely a cult.
People who just have chucked their whole lives to go follow the Reverend Moon or, you know, one of these, or the Nexium guy or something like that.
Right.
It's very, very similar. And, you know, and you get these people who just, I don't know, they're inculcated with these cultic beliefs, you know, and you hear these interviews with people like, yeah, I really thought I was doing the right thing, that our country was really under threat and was going to be destroyed and I had to go there and fight. And it's just like, I almost feel sorry for them. Not quite. But almost, because they've been completely snookered and taken in. But I don't feel totally sorry for them, because I think in some ways you have to want to be taken in. But they were, you know.
Yeah, so. You feel bad for them. You want to like help them out, but it's like then they do something and you're like, okay, you know, I can't. I don't know how to deal with you people. And I kind of ranted about this on the show before. It's like the whole thing, like, oh, they're going to take our guns away. It's like, how many times are you going to fall for this shit? How many times, like, how long are you going to believe that there's some grand plan for them to take? I'm 45 years old, dude. I've been hearing they're going to take our guns away for like 20 fucking years. It's like, they're not going to take your fucking guns away, dude. Like, you need to let that fucking go. It's not happening. They couldn't even do it if they wanted to, because guess what? You have guns.
I think a lot of people are just bored with their lives, and I think that's kind of what a lot of this comes down to. They're just bored. They don't have a lot of imagination. They don't know what to do with themselves. Gives you a great sense of purpose.
I'm a hero.
I'm fighting the government. They're going to come take my guns or lock me down because there's a fake virus out there, and I'm going to fight all this stuff.
Yeah, you see that with the QAnon people. They're in a digital army and shit. It's like, dude.
Suddenly you feel really important and like, wow, my life really has a meaning now, whereas it didn't before.
Yeah, no, you definitely – that's a recurring thing. I've seen that in some of the more – talk about conspiracies. Yeah, I've seen that in the more militant wing of the UFO community in recent years, where it's like these people, they become super obsessed with the UFO thing.
Oh, my God,
like,
yeah.
We're fighting in a war here, and it's like, no, you're not, dude. You're just really pissed because you're working at Lady Foot Locker, dude, and that's where life's brought you. And so, like, just get over it. You're not a part of an interstellar fucking movement here.
I know, but it just, you know, I just think again, in a way, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier about this system that sort of coerces people into this horrible meat grinder of the corporate, you know, whatever system you want to call it. That it just robs people of having any meaning in their lives. So they got to find it somewhere, you know. In a way, all these things are all connected, because, you know, if we didn't have to do that, if we actually had a society that allowed us to pursue meaning in our lives in different directions and pursue dreams and do things that we actually enjoy doing, I don't think you get nearly the amount of this insanity that we have now.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's a strange world. Now there, you wrote the book on conspiracies, a couple of books on conspiracies. Is there any one in particular that you like actually like? Because like I'm not a, certainly not a subscriber, but I'm a fan of the world of the flat earthers because I find them to be hilariously strange. But is there any like conspiracy theory that ever kind of stood out to you that you were like, oh, I kind of, you know, that's a fun one.
Fun one. I mean, in a way, they're all kind of fun. I mean, the UFO stuff is a lot of fun. That's definitely, you know, definitely entertaining. You know, I all the ones that, you know, I like things that are real. So if you look at the book, the second book that I did with my collaborator, his name was John Whalen, we wrote this book called The 50 Greatest Conspiracies of All Time, which then became the 60, and then the 70, then the 80. And so it went through five editions of The Greatest Conspiracies of All Time. And I remember the first section of the book, the first, I don't know what it was, like 15 chapters or so, were all about things that were pretty well documented, like actual real conspiracies, like the CIA's plots to kill Castro and the MKUltra program and things like that. Things that have become blown up into sort of insane conspiracy theories, but actually really happened. Stuff like that fascinates me. You know, the true machinations of government and that have really happened in history are endlessly interesting to me. And, you know, I've always been fascinated by the JFK assassination stuff. I mean, I don't have a definitive answer or one specific theory, but, you know, I've always found the official story a little difficult to believe. And I've read tons and tons of books about it, and it's just one of those things that just interests me. So, you know, I'm not out there. I'm not a dyed-in-the-wool conspiracy theorist about it, but I feel like there's something going on there that probably is part of the bigger picture of some of the other things that have happened in this country since then.
Yeah. Well, you're
like Watergate.
There you go. Yeah. Well, you raised an interesting point too, where it's like the old-timey conspiracy theorists, they like had to. I've talked about this on the show before, but it's like they had to do actual fucking research and like do work and get books and fucking go to archives and shit like that. Now it's like you don't have to leave your house to do conspiracy. And a lot of this QAnon shit and a lot of the modern day conspiracy theories, they're very reactionary. They're very real time. There's a real lack of sort of perspective in a way on what exactly went down. So it's a real change in the culture of conspiracy thinking in a way.
Yeah. I mean, it started in the 90s with the internet where you get these instant reactions to things like whether it was like the lady, the Princess Diana thing or TWA 800, the crash of that plane, these things that sort of instantly became conspiracy theories, like within minutes of the news being broadcast, you know, you'd go on. Then in those days, there was this thing called the Usenet, which was this part of the internet that was like a bulletin board. And you know, on there, you'd get all this stuff cropping up just minutes after these events were reported. Now you have social media, Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff, which is far more pervasive than the Usenet ever was. But it's just the same phenomenon on a much, much bigger scale. And, you know, I mean, it's just a substitute for thinking for people. You know, no one likes to think. People don't like to use their brain, and it's hard.
Yeah, and it's like partially like a reality show for these people. It's like, you know, they don't like. That's their interest. You know, that's their thing, and it's
that's
like, all right, man, if you're that's what you're into, I guess you know it's probably not good for you to think that like the NFL's working with the Biden administration to orchestrate the fucking winner of the Super Bowl. And somehow, like, they got Taylor Swift. It's like, I cannot even believe that, like, when I heard all that shit at the beginning of the year, it was just like, this has got to be, like, a joke or whatever. Then I, you know, then they do polls, and it's like, 1 in 5 Republicans think that the Super Bowl's been fixed, so Taylor Swift can endorse Joe Biden. And it's like, what the fuck world are you living in, dude? Not everything is a conspiracy theory.
I know. I don't, again, it's like this sort of reality bubble of their own creation. And it just makes their lives more interesting, I guess, to themselves anyway.
I suppose. Now, I got two more things to ask you about. How California works.
How California works.
How California
works. That's
coming out in a few
days. That's my new book.
Digital right now, right?
It's digital right now. You can download the Kindle version, but there'll be a better one soon. So, and the physical book, well, we're not really on video, but this is what it looks like.
Nice. I'm getting that for my brother. He lives in
all right.
Laguna Niguel? Where was the? Where was? Yeah. I know it might not be that. Where was Nixon's? San Clemente. My brother lives in San Clemente. So yeah,
yeah, San Clemente.
Get that for him.
Yeah, How California Works. It's definitely not a conspiracy book.
Right.
It's more a book about like the title says, how California works. It's about various sort of policy things and how certain government agencies work. Because I feel like, you know, there's so much misconception about government in general. And people, you know, like, oh, I hate the government. The government never does anything. But do people really know, like, how it works? Like, what really happens? Like, what these agencies do? Like, do people know, like, what the Local Agency Formation Commission, a LAFCO? Most people have never even heard of such a thing.
Yeah.
I don't even know if they exist outside of California, but in California, every county has one. And, you know, they're committees that people don't even really know about, but they sort of determine the boundaries of cities, the boundaries of county, you know, and it's very important for things like who you're paying your taxes to, like where your water is coming from, basic things in life that are governed by these government bodies that most people pay no attention to whatsoever. So that's really the theme of that book. It's almost like I hate to put it this way because it sounds so boring, because it's absolutely not boring, but it's like civics. It's like a civics lesson or course. So people can just
need it nowadays, dude.
Yeah. People so hopefully,
in general.
Yeah. And as I was writing it, I was learning all this stuff myself. I mean, I didn't come in knowing all this stuff, and I feel better for having learned it. And I hope other people will too. And just because I think, you know, as the cliche goes, but there's a lot of truth to it. Knowledge is power. And if you don't know how things work, you can't really ever make any changes. You know, you're just banging your head against the wall. But if you know how they work, well, maybe you can figure out how to turn them to your advantage and maybe make it so they work better and serve people better. And that's the point of this book. So yeah, How California Works. Hopefully it'll be out pretty soon. I haven't really heard from the publishers in a little while, but hopefully it'll be very soon. And keep an eye out for it.
And I do want to revisit one point you made about Close to Zero. You said, so I guess, what was the reaction like when the book came out? You said it was kind of like, you felt like it didn't, that it was not.
Yeah,
I mean,
it didn't get a lot of reviews. It got one really good review in the Daily Coast, which was great. But it sort of got buried, I think, which was unfortunate. But people did find it, and it sold, you know, it sold pretty well on Amazon mostly. So I was happy with it for sure, but I still feel like it could have done better and it should have done better. And I hope maybe people listening to the show will buy it, because I think it's worth reading, and I think we need to be reminded of everything that happened back then and the threat that we still face from this one person, but also his cult that follows him around. So I think people need to know about that. So I think the book is just as timely now as it was then, even though...
Oh, God, you know,
even though the pandemic itself has now receded, I think the topics that are covered in there are very relevant to what everything that's happening.
Time. Especially right now. This is like a clarion call. This is like... This book is like... I think everybody kind of wanted to put the whole pandemic behind us. And it's like, look, we're kind of right back in 2020 now politically. So let's go back, like you said, like they say, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Well, here, let's take a look at how things were 4 years ago and how it fucking went down. And you make the call there. I think I wonder if partially why the maybe reticence to or the lack of coverage of the book is maybe just people didn't want to confront that fucking idea that even if they hated Trump, they just didn't want to confront the idea that this was all or like purposely fucked up. And it also ties into, I think, and you make a point in the book too. It's like the fucking media, man. I find them so irritating. Like they won't ever just call this guy a fucking liar. Like it's always like, oh, he's circumspect with the truth, and they always use this like flowery fucking language. It's just like he's a liar, dude. He just lies constantly. Can we just
play fast and loose with the facts and that sort of thing?
Just ridiculous. So I mean, though, I think that was kind of, I think that might have been maybe sort of why there might have been sort of like a pushback or whatever to the book, where it was just like, look, we can't say that. We can't.
I know. Yeah. But, you know, for me, I'm in the position where I can say the things that you probably don't want to say or can't say if you're part of that structure, if you're working for NBC or, you know, one of these massive multinational media companies.
Right.
I'm not part of that, so I can say these things. So I just hope that, you know, I mean, like I said, I was happy with how it sold, but it could definitely have done better, and hopefully it still can, because I think it's still very much worth checking out.
Now, the final thing before I get into what's next for you, this is a totally off-topic thing, but I follow you on Twitter. I think we've interacted a little bit on Twitter when it comes to the Red Sox. How is a guy in L.A. a Red Sox fan in the first place?
Well, I'm from Massachusetts originally.
Oh, where are you from originally?
So, from Williamstown?
Okay, I'm in Burlington. So.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Yeah, no, I'm from the Berkshires. And, I just grew up a Boston sports fan, Red Sox specifically, baseball fan. But, you know, I love all the teams. I'm a big sports guy. So.
They're a real bummer these days, so it's kind of...
They are a bummer. They are a bummer, unfortunately. I liked what they did today, though. I liked that they signed Brian Bello to a 7-year extension. I thought that's the first good thing they've done, really, this whole off season, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
They're really, the mood here is really very anti, you know, they want them to, like, sell the team and shit.
I know.
You know, it's like, I don't know if they will, or I kind of feel like they won't, but it's kind of, it's just very maddening. I wax nostalgic for the days when it was like they were in the hunt for all the big free agents and everything.
I know. Well, hopefully that will come again.
Yeah.
I hope that will come again. I really do. Because this was just. You know, I'm usually pretty optimistic about the Red Sox, but this was depressing. It's like they could have done better, and they have the resources to do better. And there's no reason that they should be acting like the Oakland A's or something. It just makes no sense. So
right, exactly.
Anyway,
it's like, look, you may not have had a shot at Ohtani, but like, why not just go out there and like blow everybody out of the water, like the Dodgers did? You know?
They don't ever
seem to do that anymore.
I know. It's discouraging, especially this offseason. It was the worst of all. It's like
they
fired Chaim Bloom, but then it turns out he was really just a scapegoat. This was coming from the top this whole time, this kind of cheapskate attitude they have. So,
yeah, I think I could trace back sort of when they, you know, most recently broke my heart was, and when I kind of was like, you know what, I think I need to take a step off the bandwagon here for a while. When they traded Mookie Betts, it was just the most heartbreaking. That was when everybody kind of came to the realization. It's like, these aren't the Red Sox from the last 15 years. Like, these
are
not the 2004 Red Sox. These are not the, like, we're in it to win it Red Sox. These are the penny pinching, like, luxury tax avoiding, like, Red Sox. And it was like everybody here was just disgusted with that trade.
Well,
and it was
I don't blame him. And the fact that that 2018 team should have been a dynasty, and then they just broke it up. And I'll never understand that.
Yeah,
I mean, that was the greatest Red Sox team I've ever seen. And I've been doing this a long time. So, you know. And look, I'm old enough to have been of the age where I spent a lot of years of my life thinking I would never see the Red Sox win a World Series, and now I've seen four, so I'm very grateful for that.
Of course,
But I would definitely like to see them not just throw up their hands and give up. I don't expect a World Series every year. I know there's going to be bad years, and that's fine. I can live with that, but you got to try, and it feels like they're not trying.
Exactly, you know? Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah. And the whole thing where it's like, we got to get under the luxury tax. Just like, what? You're the fucking Boston Red Sox.
I know.
You are like, you're supposed to be one of the perennial powerhouse teams, like, that will spend no matter what. It's like, that doesn't make any sense to me. And then, you know, around here, it's like, fuck, if you want to go to Fenway Park, forget about it. You're shelling out like a couple $100 just to,
I know, it's too much,
to see a game.
It's too much. And the park, and I love the old park. I really do. I've been there many, many times, but it's just not that great, really. You know, it's just not that great. So, anyway.
What's next for you?
What's next for me? That's a good question. I think this new book probably is the main thing that I'm going to be focusing on for the moment. And I'll probably, I'm probably going to be doing a Substack newsletter. So be on the lookout for that. Yeah. So sort of talking about getting out of that corporate system, just writing for myself and hopefully any readers who want to subscribe, and hopefully some will actually pay the nominal amount to subscribe, which would be great for me. So it hasn't started yet, but I think it'll probably start within the next week or so. So if you're listening, keep an eye out for that and hopefully subscribe to it, either the free version or the paid, or hopefully the paid version. And I think that's probably my next really big project in terms of writing and writing about this stuff. And I'll cover all sorts of things too. It's like it's be good for me because it'll give me the freedom to write about kind of whatever I want. But it'll be focused a lot on political things, but also some sports and some other topics too. But it'll be my usual stuff where it's all, you know, very well researched because I really love doing research and very factual, but it's and explanatory. Hopefully people will learn things from it, but at the same time entertaining. So check it out. I don't have a specific title for it yet. I got a couple ideas, but it'll be out there. I can email you when I know, and you can tell your listeners, and hopefully they'll check it out.
Yeah, for sure. Now, do you have I never mentioned this when we started the show. Do you have a hub, a place you want to direct people to, website, anything like that?
I would say just check me out on Twitter or X or whatever it's called now. It's just at JonVankin, at John Vankin. That's my Twitter account. That's the main one, I would say. I have a website, which is jonathanvankin.net, not .com, but jonathanvankin.net. I don't really update it that much, but it's got a bunch of my writing and a bunch of other stuff about me. So, yeah, check that out, too.
All right. Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for letting me pitch and moan a lot on this one.
Oh, no, this was fun. this was a lot of fun. This is a good one.
Yeah, it was very cathartic to get the chance to talk about this stuff. You know, like
I said, it definitely is.
Revisiting that difficult time 4 years ago and not pushing it into the memory hole. We can't, we can't forget about this crazy period.
No, that's the most upsetting thing of all. People need to remember what happened and use it to motivate future actions.
Absolutely. Close to Zero was the book. Jonathan Vankin is the author. He's been the guest tonight. Thank you very much, sir. Have a great evening.
All right, you too. Great to talk to you.